Once the Zatricky and Scherer cases were linked by the CODIS hit to the same suspect, Sergeant S. Owens and Detective Conroy of the Greenville Police Criminal Investigations Unit contacted Master Sergeant Bud Cooper of the MSHP, who was still working the Scherer case. The Portageville investigators went to Greenville to compare notes about their wildly disparate crimes, MOs, and evidence. The investigators cross-checked their case files for common names, and there weren't any. So they started a multi-agency task force incorporating various law enforcement agencies from South Carolina, Tennessee, and Missouri, the FBI, the U.S. Marshals, and several prosecutors' offices. This is from the report, quote, "In 2006, a LexisNexis search was conducted of residents within varying radiuses of the Zatricky crime scene in April 1990. A second LexisNexis search was conducted of residents falling within various radiuses of a midpoint between the Scherer crime scene and the Dyersburg crime scene. The lists were then compared, and a list of individuals who were at both locations at the given times was developed. Leads were assigned, and individuals on the list were tracked and eliminated," end quote. So if you're getting all this, they ran a geographic dragnet to find men who had any kind of nexus to locations within a certain radius around each of Portageville and Greenville at the right times. It was noted that a drive between one and the other would take a traveler right through Dyersburg, Tennessee. Believe it or not, there were quite a few men who fell into this category, people who had geographical connections to both regions at the time of the murders. They actually found one guy who lived in Jenny's apartment complex at the time of her murder and also lived right near the Scherer crime scene in 1998. That turned out to be just a coincidence. But there were plenty of other men with connections to both places, and checking into them kept the task force busy. The investigators tracked down all these people and interviewed them and checked what vehicles they had registered them. They even got voluntary DNA swabs from the vast majority of them. I want to commend these civilians for their willingness to help out with the law enforcement investigation. These men, who had no connection to the situation other than that they happened to have lived in the two states involved at the right times, were completely willing to offer up their DNA on good faith. It kept the Missouri State Highway Patrol crime lab busy. DNA analyst Ruth Montgomery said she tested over 100 swabs at this time. None of them matched. As this investigative angle was being pursued, in 2008, other investigators generated a list of all white male residents at the Hidden Lakes apartment complex in 1990, and they re-interviewed some of the men listed in the original case file, one, for example, who was named several times in Jenny Zatricky's diary. He gave a buccal swab, which cleared him. They also talked to the man whose apartment Jenny had visited the night before she was killed, and obtained buccal swabs from both him and his son, who was Jenny's age. Not them either. Throughout 2008, comparison tests were run again and again against the DNA from the Zatricky and Scherer murders, and they never got a match. In 2009, the cases were once again featured on America's Most Wanted. During this time period, 2006 to 2009, over 1,200 leads were investigated. They just came up empty time and again. This is an excerpt from a 2008 Sykeston, Missouri Standard Democrat article about the now decade-old Scherer case. Quote, "Fast forward 10 years. Terry Stevens, now sheriff, is still haunted by the case. It remains a priority for his department, and one of two he has his hat set on solving before ending his career." He said, quote, "There's no way I can give you a number of how many man hours have been spent on this case. It's the most extensive possibly in the history of the department. In our vernacular, it will never be a cold case," end quote. Starting in 2001, the law enforcement agencies working the cases coordinated with the FBI's VICAP program to issue a VICAP alert about the unsolved cases. The alert included the sketch of the offender compiled with information from Stephanie, the Dyersburg shooting victim. The alert was posted on the FBI's website on July 27, 2012. Searches of the VICAP database also yielded some similar cases that the investigators looked into. It was a good idea and generated promising leads from law enforcement agencies across the midsection of the U.S., but they went nowhere. By 2017, the cases had gone quiet for some time, but behind the scenes, the agencies continued to work. Tony Scherer gave an interview to KFVS-12, saying he hadn't given up hope. Tony still lived in the same house where Sherry and Megan had been killed. He told the news outlet that he had chosen to stay there out of stubbornness. He said, "Not gonna run me out of our home." Stephen, too, stayed farming the land for a living. Neither of them spoke to the media much, but they remained quietly optimistic. Then, suddenly, on May 3, 2017, there was another case. The Memphis, Tennessee Police Department had uploaded an unknown offender's DNA sample to CODIS, and it hit to the Zittrichi and Scherer suspect. The same guy had committed those horrific murders and the rape of a juvenile in Memphis in 1997. Let's talk about that case. On March 11, 1997, the survivor, a 14-year-old girl with the initials LAM, was visiting the home of Laura P., age 47, and Laura's 17-year-old daughter, Natalie. The house was located in the 4900 block of Byron Road in Burr Clare. Laura, Natalie, and LAM had been babysitting the infant daughter of Mandy C., age 21, who had to go to a funeral that day. Mandy had just gotten back, and the five were in Laura's house when around 1 p.m. a man knocked on the door. Mandy opened it, and the man said he was searching the neighborhood for his wife's missing purse, which had been left on the roof of their car at the nearby Kmart. Mandy said they hadn't seen any purse, but she would get a piece of paper and a pen to write down his number in case they found it. As she attempted to close the door, the man pulled a revolver and pushed his way inside. He told them he had done something bad, and the police were looking for him. He had lost pursuing officers two blocks away and needed a place to calm down, he said. He said he didn't want to hurt anybody. He just needed to hide out for a half hour or so. That was all a lie, a ruse designed to calm the women down and make them think he would be leaving soon. Once inside the house, the man told the women to put the baby in the playpen and sit on the couch. While he was distracted, Mandy carefully removed the pin on her collar that indicated she was married to a police officer. She was afraid of what he might do if he saw that. The man paced in front of the TV, seemingly stressed out. Laura offered to put him in her trunk and drive him anywhere he wanted to go, if he would just not harm the girls. He ignored her. He made them all lie down on the living room floor, face down in a row, and lying very close together. He told them not to look at him. He put on a pair of yellow Rubbermaid-style dishwashing gloves, which he pulled from his back pocket, and taped their wrists behind their backs and bound their feet with duct tape, which he carried in his jacket pocket. But Laura couldn't lie on her stomach because, as she said, she was larger and couldn't breathe, so he let her sit up and tied her ankles with a phone cord he'd cut. He made sure to disconnect all the phones in the residence. Then he went and got some socks from the bedroom, but apparently decided not to gag the women. He asked them if anyone else would be coming home, and they said no. He said if someone did, he would kill them. Then he asked the women their ages and told them all to show him their butts. "It's been a long time since I've seen a good ass," he said. After seeing them, he cut the clothing off LAM with his pocket knife. He then sexually assaulted her. She begged him not to, but he ignored her. He unzipped his pants and tried to penetrate her, but kept muttering that he couldn't get it up. He told her he was going to put it in her mouth and she better not bite him. He made her move her head up and down on his penis, but he still couldn't get an erection. He tried to penetrate her again and got mad and said, "I can't get it up, I can't come, just forget it." He was on his knees breathing hard, according to Natalie, who lay right next to LAM, and she felt some liquid splash on her legs. After that, he used a pink towel to clean LAM's shoes off. It's unclear whether he had dripped semen on them or what. Then he got up, zipped up, and started looking for Laura's car keys. He asked where they were and where his duct tape was. He gathered up those things and he then left the house, driving off in Laura's red Crown Vic four-door and taking the pink towel with him. Before he left, he told the women they'd better wait a few minutes before they started screaming for help. After the door clicked behind him, they freed themselves and called police, and LAM submitted to a rape kit at the hospital. The survivors of this incident, Mandy, Natalie, Laura, and LAM, worked with Memphis police on a suspect sketch. It showed a white male with brown hair, with a bulbous nose, and a well-groomed mustache, wearing silver-framed tinted aviators and a cap. He was 5'8" tall, a wiry 140 pounds, mid-30s to mid-40s. He was wearing dark jeans, a gray t-shirt, a maroon windbreaker with white lettering on the upper front, and black tennis shoes. He had a piece of duct tape stuck to his pants leg when he left. Laura's vehicle with the pink towel still inside was found later by patrol officers at a nearby Kmart, where employees reported seeing a white male run from the car. The employees were later shown the composite sketch and confirmed that was the man they'd seen ditching the Crown Vic. They also said they'd seen the man in the store earlier that day. Maybe he was buying the rubber gloves and duct tape. The Memphis Police Department had worked LAM's case and tried to find the rapist, but I'm going to be honest here, they didn't try that hard. They didn't test LAM's rape kit for the offender's DNA. You heard me right. They shelved it. LAM was raped in 1997. In 2013, the Memphis PD did an inventory of its untested rape kits. It turned out there were over 12,000 of them. LAM's was just one. Can I just say how much this makes my blood boil? This brave, strong 14-year-old girl gave an absolutely incredibly detailed, very matter-of-fact informational statement to police about her assault and her disgusting, horrible, violent assailant. Yet no one bothered to test her rape kit. It's as good as the police and legislators who establish budgets saying, "We don't care." Anyway, years later, the federal government issued grants under the SACE program to help states clean up this unconscionable mess. But I cringe thinking about the number of serious crimes that could have been prevented if these rape kits had been entered into CODIS years earlier and the perpetrators held accountable. As a result of the SACE program, LAM's rape kit was finally tested in 2017, 20 years after the incident. And lo and behold, it hit to the Shearer and Zatricky cases. It was the same guy and yet another state. Once the Missouri and South Carolina investigators were notified that their guy had struck yet again, they compared the composite sketch of the Memphis suspect to the composite sketch done after his attack on Stephanie in Dyersburg. When you look at them, you can certainly tell that these people were trying to draw the same person, MSHP Master Sergeant Bud Cooper told KVFS-12. The 2017 CODIS connection to yet a third case revitalized the Shearer investigation. It had never gone cold, it was continually worked, but now there was yet another suspect sketch to go on, yet another MO to study, living witnesses to interview, and the police dug in with gusto. "I would say there's renewed hope, and that's what it is, renewed," Bud Cooper told KFVS-12. "I think there's been hope from day one." Sheriff Terry Stevens added, quote, "I can't speak for everybody, but myself as the sheriff, I'm very optimistic that we're going to solve this case." The Missouri State Highway Patrol, New Madrid County Sheriff's Office, Greenville, South Carolina Police Department, and Memphis, Tennessee Police Department all worked together. Now they had a third geographic region to include in their search for men with nexuses to the crime scenes. This from the report, quote, "In late 2017, a second LexisNexis search was conducted, incorporating the LAM crime scene. The results were negative with the inclusion of the Shearer crime scene. A search was then conducted using only the Zatricky crime scene and the LAM crime scene. The results of that search returned a list of 14 individuals living near the Zatricky and LAM scenes. Leads were assigned, and the individuals on the list were tracked down and eliminated." Again, it was a good idea and good police work, but it didn't lead to police finding their man. The report continues, quote, "In January 2018, an in-depth case review of the Shearer double homicide case was initiated," end quote. Investigators began working with the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, but even the BAU couldn't solve the case. It was going to take the advent of forensic genealogy to do that, and the timing was perfect. In April 2018, the Golden State Killer was identified in California, and forensic genealogy took the law enforcement world by storm. Detective Stephen Shepard of the Memphis Police Department's DNA unit was charged with trying to solve open sexual assault cases from 1976 to 2013, the year the department pushed to test all the untested rape kits and evidence. Shepard was instrumental in getting LAM's rape kit tested, which revealed they were seeking a serial offender. After they struck out testing the DNA of local suspects in LAM's rape, Detective Shepard proposed using this new technique he had heard was solving some high-profile cases, forensic genealogy. After getting the go-ahead from the Missouri, South Carolina, and Tennessee investigators, Shepard arranged for $15,000 in funding to pay for preparation of a SNP profile and contracting with Parabon Nanolabs. The swab from Megan Shearer's left breast had been used up, and there wasn't enough DNA left in the Zatricky case, but now they had a fresh sample from LAM's rape kit. That was a sample they used to provide the SNP to Parabon in July 2018. The genealogist was Cece Moore. Cece entered the suspect's SNP profile into GEDmatch. In the database, she found a number of DNA relatives of the suspect. DNA relative number 1 shared 686 centimorgans with the suspect. DNA relative number two, shared 520 centimorgans of DNA with him. As we know, these are pretty good measurements. As Cece described it, these top two DNA relatives also shared a fair amount of DNA with each other, meaning they were in the same genetic network. And based on the amount of DNA they each shared with the suspect, they were possibly first cousins once removed with him. So, she tried to find the most recent common ancestor of these two DNA relatives, building their family tree back to the second great-grandparent level. It turned out they were both descended from common ancestors John and Lucy Brashears, who lived in Greene County, Arkansas. John was a farmer, Lucy was a mother and homemaker. According to the 1880 census, the couple had four children. Cece painstakingly built this family tree down to include all John and Lucy's children and grandchildren. This was just one genetic network in the suspect's family tree, and Cece didn't have representation of both sides of the suspect's family tree. She knew he had to be somewhere in this Brashears tree, but she didn't have the benefit of knowing names involved in another intersecting marriage that could help her pinpoint which branch the suspect fell in. So she had to build out the entire family tree, properly placing each descendant of John and Lucy Brashears and everyone they married. She knew the suspect was likely a great-great-grandson of the Brashears. But it was confusing, because while she knew the top two DNA relatives were likely first cousin once removed with the suspect, for some reason that didn't fit with what she was seeing at the second great-grandchild level. These two probable first cousins once removed were not in the same generation as each other. The answer came when Cece found out that John and Lucy Brashears' son, Obadiah Memory Brashears, had married Lydia Garner in December 1890. They had sons Isaac, John, and William. Keeping it all in the family, John and William married sisters Hester and Elva Mahan. Their children were therefore double first cousins, sharing double the amount of DNA of typical first cousins. This led Cece to the conclusion that the suspect was a first cousin once removed with the top DNA relative and double second cousins with DNA relative 2. This confirmed that the suspect was indeed most likely a great-great-grandson of John and Lucy Brashears. Cece found several candidates who could be the suspect in terms of level of shared DNA and position on the tree, so she had to look at location, age, criminal record, and so on. She found a set of three brothers from Alabama, last name Brashears, two of whom had criminal records. But one of the brothers with a record had died before any of the crimes in Missouri, Tennessee, and South Carolina were committed. So she set her sights on the other one, Robert Eugene Brashears. She noted his significant criminal record, in particular, a crime that was startlingly similar to his suspected M.O. And his daughter, Deborah, had a public Facebook page with a photo of her father, which was a dead ringer for the sketch from the Memphis rape case. And he was wearing the exact same hat and the same transition-style aviators. Parabon's report to the Missouri, Tennessee, and South Carolina investigators dated August 22, 2018, indicated that Parabon had a high degree of certainty that the suspect was Robert E. Brashears. Parabon's report highlighted Brashears' extensive criminal history and that he had residential addresses in close proximity to all three crimes, including one less than a mile from Jenny Zetricki's apartment complex. Cece told me it took her less than 10 hours to come up with his name, which was nowhere in the multiple thousands of pages of case files spanning four jurisdictions. And by the time the investigators got his name in the form of an investigative lead from Parabon, Robert Brashears had been dead for 19 years. It was time to test Cece's hypothesis. Brashears was dead, but he had a wife, a living brother, and two daughters from different women. All these people were contacted by the investigators, and all gave voluntary DNA samples for kinship testing. This from the report, quote, "The DNA samples obtained from Brashears' relatives were then sent to the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division Forensic Services Laboratory and to the Missouri State Highway Patrol Crime Lab for analysis. Each laboratory confirmed that the suspect DNA profile linked to the Zetricki and Scherer homicides and LAM's rape would be that of the father to Brashears' daughters. The testing also eliminated the surviving brother as a suspect in the crimes. However, the testing confirmed the surviving brother would indeed be a brother to the suspect whose DNA profile was found in the crimes." End quote. The SLED lab had determined it was 19 trillion times more likely that Brashears' daughter Deborah was the daughter of the suspect than of any other man, but it still wasn't enough. This guy was a triple murderer and a rapist. They wanted to be sure. So they dug him up. Brashears was buried in the Shiloh Cemetery, located at 5811 West Kings Highway in Paragould, Arkansas, grave C-112. Investigators got a court order to exhume him, and the Greenville Police Department came up with the approximately $1,300 needed to pay for the exhumation. On September 27, 2018, they opened his grave. The FBI evidence recovery team was on site to assist with collection of the evidence. Detective Conworth's report says, quote, "I was given a tooth, small left toe, small left finger, a bone from the left foot, a bone from the left hand, and a pulled head hair," end quote. Missouri detectives were given other body parts, including a humerus bone. I'll skip the suspense. The report says, quote, "The probability of randomly selecting an individual having a DNA profile matching the DNA profile foreign to Brashears is approximately 1 in 65 octillion." It was him. At long last, the murders of Jenny Zetricki and Megan and Sherry Shearer, the rape of LAM, and the shooting of Stephanie W. had been solved. So who was Robert Eugene Brashears? Brashears was born on March 13, 1958, in Newport News, Virginia, to parents Dulles Woodrow Woody Brashears and mother Nellie McClellan Brashears. He had two brothers, 7 years older Woody Jr., and another brother whom I'm calling by his initials, G.B. G.B., who lived in Huntsville, told the investigators about his ne'er-do-well brother Robert. He said that after Woody Sr. and Nellie divorced, Brashears went into a rebellious stage and was sent to South Bend, Indiana, to live with their father. He graduated from high school in Indiana, and after that, in March 1976, he enlisted with the U.S. Navy in El Paso, Texas. He attended the Naval Air Technical Training Center located at the Naval Air Station in Memphis, Tennessee, from July until August 1976, and was assigned to the USS Lexington in Pensacola, Florida, in December 1976. Well, it seems like Brashears pretty quickly regretted the whole join the Navy's serve your country decision. He started complaining about various ailments that might exclude him from duty. He reported to Navy doctors that he had had surgery on his right knee to repair cartilage in November 1970. He reported that he had a venereal disease. He began reporting things like depression and acid indigestion. In the staff psychologist's printed consultation reports, he describes many of the symptoms as, quote, psychophysiological gastrointestinal complaints, which, quote, resulted in an upper GI series with normal findings, end quote. In other words, Brashears was faking it. By September 1976, he was flat out just saying that he disliked Navy service and wanted out. Staff psychologist John Aitken subsequently described Brashears as having an inadequate personality for naval service. Brashears was discharged in December 76. After that, he returned to Huntsville, Alabama, where his brother, G.B., was living. He then spent time in New Orleans, Louisiana, Texas, and Arkansas, doing God knows what. I probably don't have to explain why investigators were so intent on nailing down a concrete timeline for Robert Brashears. This guy was the worst-case scenario. A roving, violent offender who had no ties to anywhere or anyone, had no scruples, and was smart enough to cover his tracks. They were convinced that he had an untold number of heinous crimes under his belt, and they did everything they could do to flush them out. Brashears had had a relationship with a young woman that resulted in a daughter. The two had met in January 1979, while Brashears was working as a bartender at T.P. Crockmeyer's in Huntsville, Alabama. They dated for 6 months, and then the woman left for school in France, and Brashears moved to New Orleans, and they lost touch. He wrote her a letter from prison in Florida in the mid-1980s, and then once he was out in 1989, he asked to take their daughter on a trip, and she said no. Smart lady. Brashears' mother, Nellie, died in 1980 in Newport News, Virginia, at only 50 years of age. Brashears attended her funeral there. Brashears was married only once that we know of. The investigators extensively interviewed his wife, Rose Marie. She told them the two met in March 1989 while she was working as a waitress at Shoney's in Huntsville, Alabama. Oddly, Brashears shared the same middle name as her father, Eugene. The two started dating and were an on-again, off-again couple for the next 10 years. Rose Marie was aware that right before they met, Brashears had been released from a prison in Florida, where he'd been incarcerated for shooting a woman in the head. Rose Marie's family knew about Brashears' violent past, and she said her family despised him. Nonetheless, the two were together on and off for years, as Brashears was in and out of prison and constantly on the move. They had their daughter Deborah in 1991, but she was born after Rosemarie had caught Brashear's cheating, and he was living in Georgia while she and the baby were in Alabama. It's unclear how the next few years unfolded. Police notes indicate that when they interviewed Rosemarie, she was very fuzzy on the details, was unhelpful and recalcitrant, and was visibly intoxicated. Rosemarie described a physical fight she once had with Brashear's that resulted in him being arrested. They argued and she hit him on the head with a drill. The police were called and Brashear's, who was wanted on federal weapons charges, was arrested and sent to prison. It's unclear whether this story was true, but he definitely did spend some time in federal prison while the two were an item. Rosemarie said they stayed in touch by writing thousands of letters back and forth. When he was released in 1997, Brashear's moved in with Rosemarie, their daughter Deborah, and Rosemarie's older twin girls in Paragould, Arkansas. Rosemarie said that during this time in the late 90s, Brashear's was working as a carpenter with his own business and a custom-made van to hold all his tools. He would disappear for days at a time, presumably on work trips. This from the police report, quote, "Rosemarie attempted to portray Brashear's as a good man until he began doing drugs in Paragould," end quote. On one of these supposed work trips at the end of March 1998, he killed Megan and Sherry. Paragould is just 64 miles from Portageville. Just 2 weeks later, on April 12, 1998, Brashear's was arrested after an attempted burglary. After this incident, he and Rosemarie abruptly got married on April 20th. She said later, because he did not want her to be forced to testify against him. Okay, let's talk about Brashear's criminal history and timeline. His multiple arrests were for charges of attempted murder, burglary, impersonating a police officer, and unlawful possession of a weapon. He also told Rosemarie of several robberies, and he told his earlier girlfriend, the one who had moved to France, that he and his brother had once kidnapped a person and stole their van. Brashear's had reportedly idolized his older brother, Woody Brashear's Jr., 7 years his senior, the one he claimed was his accomplice in a kidnapping. In 1979, Woody Jr. and his buddy David Ledbetter had committed an armed robbery at Sandy's used car dealership in Decatur, Alabama, that had turned deadly. The two of them held up the used car lot clerk at gunpoint, tied him up, got $200 in cash, and stole a Datsun 280Z, a sweet sports car from the 70s era that probably had shades on the back window and Playboy Bunny mudguards. The two sped off, one of them driving the stolen car and the other in their own car. But because these guys were idiots, the police were quickly on their tail. When they stopped for gas at the Beddingfield General Merchandise Store in Mooresville, Alabama, State Trooper David Temple approached the Z. The driver, Woody Brashear's, shot Temple twice with his pistol. As the wounded trooper tried to get up, Brashear's got out of his car and executed the trooper on the ground. The two men then sped away, but other troopers and officers were in pursuit, and Brashear's soon wrecked the Z in a soybean field in Madison, Alabama. Policemen surrounded him, and as Madison policeman Eliel Velez approached him, Brashear's shot him. The wounded officer returned fire, hitting Woody Jr. in the chest and killing him. That was it for him, and police were very surprised to learn that he had worked for the Huntsville PD as a fingerprint technician 6 years earlier. He probably imparted all he knew about fingerprint identification to his younger brother Robert, who wore gloves when he committed his crimes. By the way, Officer Velez survived. Robert Brashear's was 27 when he committed his first known violent crime. As I mentioned, he told his girlfriend that he and his brother Woody Jr. had kidnapped someone, but that victim has never been linked to Brashear's. On November 11, 1985, a young woman named Michelle Wilkerson accepted a ride from Robert Brashear's near Fort Pierce, Florida. Brashear's drove to a nearby orchard and pulled over and demanded sexual favors from Michelle. She refused and grabbed the gun he had pulled on her. Brashear's shot her twice in the head at close range, but she managed to get out of the truck and run. She ended up crawling through an 18-inch wide water and mud-filled culvert while Brashear's searched for her on the other side of the road. He gave up and drove off, and she emerged from the other end of the culvert and ran to an unoccupied office to use the phone. Officers were able to get to her at 3 a.m. and rush her to the hospital, where she survived. According to the Palm Beach Post, Michelle was able to give a detailed description of her attacker. 2 hours later, a man who fit Michelle's description got his truck stuck in the sand at Frederick Douglass Beach. Quick-thinking deputy Angela Darling recognized him from the APB, and Robert Brashear's was charged with attempted first-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, aggravated battery, and the use of a firearm in the commission of a felony. In November 1986, he was convicted of attempted second-degree murder. He started serving his 15-year sentence on December 19, 1986, and was released on May 4, 1989. Yep, that's 3.5 years, for kidnapping a woman, trying to rape her, and shooting her in the head. Just about a year later, in April 1990, he killed Jenny Zatricky. At that time, Brashears was living in Greenville at an apartment complex now called The Park at Benito, located at 25 Pelham Road. He worked for the complex as a maintenance man. This complex was quite near where Jenny Zatricky lived. Brashears was also issued a South Carolina driver's license, which I think was under his father, Woody Sr.'s name, so he was likely a South Carolina resident for at least a few months. At some point, he came across Jenny and must have decided to target her. In another interaction with law enforcement, police in Cobb County, Georgia, arrested Brashears on February 18, 1992. Police saw a stolen truck in a motel parking lot, and Brashears was driving it under an assumed name on a Tennessee license. He had asked the motel clerk to give him a room in the rear of the building because he didn't want his ex-wife to find his vehicle, he said. But that was a lie. It's because the truck was hot and he didn't want the cops to see it. But they did, and searches of the truck and the hotel room revealed a whole slew of suspicious items, such as a stolen pistol with the registration numbers filed off, a brown sheriff's deputy jacket with a sheriff's department logo, a security guard badge, a police scanner, which when turned on was monitoring local police frequencies, a police code book, a radar detector, a telephone used by phone company repairmen to make calls from the junction box, and a Radio Shack police call radio guide. In two nylon suitcases next to the bed, police found a Slim Jim device used to enter locked vehicles, three pairs of rubber surgical gloves, and, quote, numerous tools and items too numerous to be listed, which can be, and commonly are, used in the commission of entering and stealing autos, end quote. They also found handcuffs, a whole bunch more police paraphernalia, and various birth certificates and driver's licenses in fake names. This is the only time Brashears was interviewed by police where transcripts of the interview still exist. When they asked him why he had all that stuff, he told the officers he was a private investigator. He also said he used to be a paralegal, and no, he'd never been arrested. Then he said the truth was, he was using all that stuff to spy on and rip off some big-time drug dealers. They asked him why some of his papers in his room were signed R.E.B., since he had a different name on his driver's license. Of course, those are Brashear's real initials. He said he signed things R.E.B. because his nickname was Rebel. How do you know this guy is lying? Because his mouth is moving. The Cobb County investigators knew this guy was full of shit, and they finally identified him as Robert Brashears. It turned out the name he was using was a cousin in Texas. They ran a record search and watched as criminal history information rolled in from Florida, Louisiana, and Texas, as well as a fugitive warrant out of New Mexico for trying to cross the border in a stolen truck. Here is exactly what Brashears finally fessed up to the Cobb County investigators, quote, the following is a synopsis of the suspect's activities in response to our questions. On Thanksgiving morning, 1991, the suspect was caught in bed with a woman whom he'd been having an affair with by her husband, who happened to be an Atlanta police officer. A firearm was allegedly displayed. Fearing for his safety, the suspect fled from the house and returned to a house where he had been staying in Canton, Georgia. On November 29, 1991, he said he stole the truck from Southern Surveying and Mapping and fled west, intending to see relatives in Phoenix, Arizona. While en route, he was stopped at the U.S. Border Patrol checkpoint and arrested for possession of the stolen truck and gun. After his bond was posted in New Mexico by relatives, he fled the area fearing a long jail term because of his prior record, which included a conviction for attempted homicide in Florida. He took a bus from Las Cruces, New Mexico to Brownsville, Texas, and a plane from there to Dallas, Texas. From Dallas, he took a bus to Tyler, Texas, where he stole the truck he had when he was arrested by us. From Tyler, he went to Huntsville, Alabama, where he visited with a daughter he has from a common-law marriage. From Huntsville, he came through the metro Atlanta area en route to North and South Carolina. In Charlotte, North Carolina, he stole the tag that was on the truck when he was arrested. He wound up in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, where he obtained the birth certificate in his cousin's name so he could develop a new identity. After having the document sent to him via FedEx, he applied for and received a Tennessee driver's license in the cousin's name. He spent time in the Chattanooga, Tennessee area looking for a bartending job and wound up back in Cobb, Marietta, just existing on doing odd jobs at different places, end quote. Okay, now you get why police had a hard time recreating Brashear's travels. This guy was all over the place, using fake names, stealing cars, and deliberately covering his tracks. He was essentially untraceable. Anyway, Brashears was sentenced to 5 years on the stolen vehicle and gun possession charges. He served his time and was released in February 1997. Within a month, in March 97, he committed the home invasion rape of the 14-year-old LAM, the one where he tied up the four women on the floor. Then he moved in with his on-again, off-again girlfriend, Rose Marie, in Paragould, Arkansas. Either he behaved himself for a while, or we just don't know about any more crimes in the next 12 months. But on April 12, 1998, Brashears was arrested in Paragould after a citizen called the police about a prowler. Here's an excerpt from the probable cause affidavit, dated April 13, 1998, quote, "On 12 April 1998 at approximately 4:30 a.m., officers were called to 715 West Main Street in reference to a man who appeared to be trying to get inside a neighbor's front door. Upon arrival, officers found the male subject squatted down beside the driver's side tire of the victim's vehicle. The subject was intoxicated and arrested. The subject had wire cutters in his back pocket and was carrying a video camera in a duffel bag. The area around the vehicle was searched, and a loaded .22 caliber revolver and a pair of gloves were found behind the tire where the suspect was kneeling at the time of the arrest. It was later discovered the victim's phone lines had been cut." End quote. Brashears had tried to break into the home of a single woman for whom he had previously done some handyman work. He told Rose Marie later that this woman had spoken badly of him and he wanted to get even with her. But police think that was a lie he told Rose Marie to explain his behavior. They believe Brashears' intention was to rape and murder this woman, based on the tools, implements, and weapon he had with him when he cut the phone lines and tried to get into her house in the middle of the night. Brashears was charged with attempted residential burglary, felon in possession of a firearm, and criminal mischief. Despite all that, he was released on a $5,000 bond. He would never see the inside of a prison again. Now, in August 2018, Missouri State Patrol Corporal N.H. McDaniel spoke to officers at the Paragould Police Department about the April 1998 arrest of Robert Brashears. McDaniel knew that just 2 weeks before this arrest, Brashears had killed Megan and Sherry Shearer, so he was very interested in what the police file said about this arrest. But the file was gone. There were no more records other than the PC affidavit I just read from. McDaniel did speak with Paragould Chief of Police Todd Stovall and Captain Brendan Baldridge, both of whom were involved in the arrest of Robert Brashears back in April of 1998. Captain Baldridge said, quote, "He remembered searching Brashears and located a tub of cream in his front pocket. He remembered asking Brashears about the cream. Brashears told him it was for venereal warts," end quote. Back to the 1998 timeframe. On April 20th, Brashears and Rose Marie got married so she could not be required to bear witness against him in court, and then he went on the run. The family didn't hear from him again until the winter of 1999. On January 13th, Brashears contacted Rose Marie at her home in Paragould and asked her to come with the girls to Kennett, Missouri. He had obtained a hotel room at the Super 8 Motel at 1801 First Street under the name of Mitch Something, a former cellmate. She went to the hotel and Brashears had a nice reunion with his family, but it very quickly turned bad. When Rosemarie got to the Super 8, she learned that Brashears had robbed a Radio Shack and a Shoney's in Tennessee. He had worn a blonde wig, a regular MO of his when he committed his crimes, and he thought it was funny that he had said to the Shoney's register lady, "Coffee to stay and money to go." Rosemarie also knew that Brashears had stolen a Dodge Aries. It was parked outside the motel where he hoped police would not see it, but they did. Here's an excerpt of a report by Kennett Police Officer John Beaton. Quote, "On January 12, 1999, at 23:32 hours, this officer, John Beaton, ran a check on a suspicious vehicle that was parked at the Super 8 Motel. The vehicle was described as a gray Dodge Aries four-door with Indiana plates 480-9038. The vehicle's trunk lock was missing, and the back driver's side window was missing. Communications Officer Lieutenant Mark Goddard advised me that the license plate on the vehicle was stolen. At that time, Officer Trowbridge and Corporal Gordon Crawford arrived on the scene. Officer did a check of the vehicle's content. Officer Trowbridge found information regarding the owner of the vehicle. Myself and Officer Trowbridge contacted the employee of the motel and requested a check of the occupants occupying the rooms. We then found that the owner of the vehicle was located in room 323. So looking inside the stolen car, the police officers saw things that belonged to kids. So they went to the front desk clerk and asked who in the motel had kids in the room. The clerk said, Mitch in room 323 does. The cops knocked on the door. Rosemarie answered it, and the police report says she was visibly drunk. In the room with her were three little girls. Police quickly searched the room, finding a 9mm automatic pistol, several ID cards, a police scanner, and a handful of bullets. This from the report filed by Officer Tim Trowbridge of the Kennett PD, quote, "The woman stated that the car was hers, however, she did not know anything about the plates. I then asked her about the man to whom the room was registered to, which she stated that he had been gone for about 3 hours. She then gave verbal permission to search the room." Just as an aside here, the three little girls in the room were asleep at this time. Back to the report. While searching the room, I noticed that someone was hiding under the bed. Myself and Corporal Crawford repeatedly ordered the suspect to come out from under the bed and show his hands. After a few minutes, I drew a firearm and covered Crawford as he pulled the mattress from the bed. When pulled back, we revealed the suspect who had a small, semi-automatic pistol pointed at his head. End quote. Brashears was hiding under the bed, and rather than come out with his hands up, he was holding himself hostage. Rosemarie and Deborah, his 7-year-old daughter, later said that he said multiple times when the cops knocked on the door, "I'm not going back to prison." Brashears no doubt believed the police had caught up with him for his horrific crimes in Memphis, Portageville, Dyersburg, and Greenville. But they hadn't. They were literally just looking for whoever stole that Dodge Aries. They had no idea who he was. But Brashears jumped the gun and he ended up paying for it. So bear in mind what's happening here. You have a small hotel room, a typical Super 8 room, with Brashears, Rosemarie, and three kids. Brashears is under the bed and the cops are searching the room. They see Brashears and that he has a gun. One of the officers in the room quickly radioed for backup, while another dealt with Rosemarie. Officer Trowbridge started ordering Brashears out from under the bed, pointing his service weapon at him. At this, Rosemarie attacked Deputy Mark Dennis. She tried to punch and kick him, nailing him in the groin. As the report says, she became very loud and combative. Officer Beaton assisted in placing her in cuffs, and she continued to scream and swear at Officer Dennis. She and the kids were then escorted out of the hotel room and placed in the hallway. This commotion must have been scary for the other motel guests at 12:30 in the morning. I didn't see anything about the police vacating the hotel. Officer Steve Williams' report says, quote, "I entered the room 323 and I saw a white male sitting on the floor on the west side of the room, holding an automatic pistol against the right side of his head. Also in the room were Officers Crawford, Beaton, and Trowbridge, and Craig Crow. I ordered the man to place the weapon on the floor, however he refused, and told me he wanted us to get out of the room because he wanted to call his attorney. I told the officers to get out of the room. After we left the room, the man locked the door and refused to come out. Officer Crow negotiated with the man by telephone, and we also talked to him at the door of the room for over 4 hours. But the man still refused to come out of the room. At one point, he opened the door and threw out some clothing items that belonged to the woman and the children. And he also threw out a 9mm automatic pistol with a loaded magazine. He also threw out 7 .380 caliber bullets, but refused to throw out the pistol he had been holding against his head." End quote. Meanwhile, Rosemarie had been taken down to the Kennett PD station and questioned. I'm not sure whether she revealed his real name or whether the police figured it out, but a computer check of the name Robert Eugene Brashears revealed all his outstanding warrants, of which there were several, including a weapons offense warrant from the U.S. Marshal's Office and a failure to appear for the burglary arrest in Paragould. Resuming the police report, Dunklin County Sheriff Bob Holder and Sergeant Dennis Rainey of the Missouri State Highway Patrol arrived on the scene to assist in the incident, and we continued to negotiate with Brashears. However, he refused to come out of the room. At approximately 4:30 a.m., Wednesday, January 13, 1999, a shot was heard from inside the room. A tear gas canister was shot through the window of the room, however, he did not respond. So police raided the room and found Brashears lying on the floor on his back. The gun was in his right hand. He had a gunshot entry wound to the right temple and an exit wound on his left temple. Despite the through and through in his head, he was still breathing. EMS, who had been called to the scene earlier, then transported him to Twin Rivers Regional Medical Center. Police investigators collected the remaining evidence in the hotel room. A shell casing lying on the floor 4 inches from Brashears' head, the pistol, a black briefcase containing bullets, and a wig. They also noted a bullet hole in the wall where the bullet had gone through Brashears' head and had penetrated the sheetrock. When they notified Rosemarie about Bashir's being in the hospital in dire condition, she told them how it came to be that the entire family was in the motel room in Kennett. Her husband was wanted for a burglary in Paragould was all she knew. She also said he had a lot of money on him and she didn't know where he got it. When the police knocked on the door of the motel, Bashir told her he was not going to go to prison for the rest of his life, and he handed her $8,000 in cash before slipping under the bed with his gun. Bashir was kept alive on life support for 6 days while his healthy organs were harvested. Yes, this sadistic murderer was an organ donor. I hope they didn't tell any recipients the nature of the man their hearts, lungs, and livers came from. Finally, the machines were turned off on January 19, 1999. Bashir's family held a funeral service for the 40-year-old at Heath Funeral Home in Paragould. After his death, investigators ran the gun Bashir shot himself with through the NCIC database to see if it was linked to any other crimes. They didn't find anything. Robert Bashir went to his grave known only for the somewhat petty burglaries, auto thefts, and weapons charges he had racked up, and the one attempted murder in Florida. Little did they know how much worse crimes he was responsible for. Okay, now back to late 2018, when the investigators had exhumed Robert Bashir's, tested his DNA, and conclusively linked him to the murders and rapes in three different states. The investigators went back to talk to Bashir's family members to try to get some more details on these crimes and determine if he was responsible for any more. Rosemarie was, as I have indicated, not super helpful to the police. She claimed not to remember much of anything. She alleged Bashir was gone quite often and she didn't know what he did while he was away. She denied any knowledge of him ever living in South Carolina. Quote, she acted as though she was very surprised he lived there, end quote. She also denied him telling her he ever killed anyone. Rosemarie said that after Bashir killed himself, she burned all his belongings. She was mad at him for committing suicide. She told the police that Bashir was, quote, messed up in the head. You don't say. Bashir's daughter, Deborah, has been very vocal about her feelings about the revelation that her biological father was a sadistic rapist and murderer. In September 2018, she spoke with New Madrid Sheriff's Captain Chris Hensley, Alabama State Bureau of Investigation Agent Justin Kinney, and FBI Special Agent Martin Williams. This was when they asked her for a buckle swab, the first time she learned that her father was a suspect in some seriously heinous crimes. She knew he was involved in writing bad checks, robbery, vehicle theft, and weapons charges, but nothing about murder or rape of children. She put together that Bashir was dating her mother, Rosemarie, when he killed Jenny Zetricki, and was living with the family when he murdered the Shearers. Deborah was understandably very upset at this news. She told the investigators that she didn't know anything about her dad ever living or being in South Carolina, but knew that he had traveled all over the place. She said as a kid, she always had nice things because her father wrote checks with invisible ink pens, and that her mom later told her he would rob places dressed up as a woman. He had a friend who was a locksmith who had helped him steal cars. Deborah didn't know who her father was until he showed up after getting out of prison in February 1997. She had really only lived with him for about a year. She said he was really fun and a great dad, although she described three times when he hit the kids in violent fits of rage after they did something he didn't like being too noisy. And she recalled one incident where Bashir, whom she said was an alcoholic, tried to take the kids to the liquor store and Rosemarie beat him up and kicked him in the crotch. After that, he apologized and begged all of them for forgiveness. Deborah also recalled that her dad was obsessed with the news. He always had it on. Now she realized that was so he would know what was going on with the investigations of the cases he was involved in. The Shearer case came on the TV news and they watched the story together as a family. They even saw the sketch. Not for one second had she thought, that's my dad. Deborah spoke extensively to the Greenville News. Here's a quote from the article, quote, after his death, Deborah said she found an audio recording of Bashir's centered around him experimenting with pain. She said he recorded himself cutting his own arm and neck with a skill saw to see if he could withstand the pain. There had to be something wrong with his brain. It just makes me sick to my stomach. There's no telling how many lives he ruined. He was a wolf in sheep's clothing, she said. She said if she could, she would apologize to her father's victims' families. He got what he deserves. He's burning in hell. As we heard, Deborah cooperated with the investigators and gave buckle swabs to inform them whether they were on the right track with Bashir's. She also gave them a copy of the only photo she had of her dad, the one Cece Moore had seen, where he was wearing the same hat as in one of the victim's sketches. Deborah was interviewed on Cece Moore's show, The Genetic Detective. Cece, how did you feel? Answer from Deborah, disgusted. I feel like I'm fixing to start crying. Is that where my anger comes from? Is that why? I mean, I've been angry for a long time, and my father for taking his own life. And now I'm angry that I even met him, and I even know him because part of my blood is the blood of a serial killer. They say, oh, maybe, you know, some things are genetic, and is that going to have, you know, any effect on my life? But at the same time, like everyone's told me, regardless of how mad I get, no matter what, I'm my own person. Cece, how do you feel about the fact that we identified your father through his cousins uploading their DNA? Answer from Deborah. I'm glad that's the way y'all found him. I really am. The more that people see this as a good thing, the more people will do what they need to do to help people get caught. Hear, hear. Meanwhile, on September 4th, 2018, Greenville, South Carolina Detective T. Conroy and Corporal C. D. Hamlet interviewed Brashear's brother, G.B. G.B. was a pastor in Alabama. He did not have particularly good memories of his brother, whom he saw as a user, a grifter, and a fraud. He told them that at some point in the 1980s, Brashears had told G.B. he had killed someone. If this is true, this crime has not yet been linked to Brashears. G.B. said that his brother really only contacted him when he needed money. Brashears tried to convince G.B. that he had found religion while he was in prison, but G.B. did not believe him. He said he and his wife ultimately cut ties with his brother. This was because in 1992, G.B. lost his security clearance, which he needed in connection with his employment in the aerospace industry. He lost it because Brashears had been fraudulently using G.B.'s social security number and had gotten caught. It took G.B. several years to get this off his record. G.B. also said that after Brashears got out of prison in 97, he went to Arkansas, where he spent some time living with their father, Woody Sr. G.B. knew nothing of Brashears being in South Carolina or Georgia, two states where he had either lived or been arrested. But he surmised that Brashears might have stolen Woody Sr.'s identity to get a South Carolina driver's license, because Woody got a notification in the mail that it was going to be revoked when he had never applied for a South Carolina license in the first place. G.B. said he encouraged his dad to cut ties with the black sheep of the family, Robert. G.B. was also the one who told the investigators that Brashears had idolized their older brother, Woody Jr., who had died in a shootout after killing an Alabama state trooper. What a role model. When they were done interviewing all Brashears' family members, the investigators worked to establish any other links they could find between Brashears and the crimes they knew he had committed, or additional crimes they didn't already know about. They ran various records checks and learned that Brashears' name was not in the law enforcement databases in the Greenville, South Carolina area or the Memphis, Tennessee area. The same was true in New Madrid County. It was like he was a ghost. He would materialize in a jurisdiction, commit a heinous crime, and vanish without a trace. While he lived nearby, he wasn't close enough to be canvassed either, and if he was, like in South Carolina, he might have been using a different name. And of course, he wasn't in CODIS for the Florida attack on Michelle. That crime was committed in the 1980s, before CODIS existed, before DNA was the gold standard in crime fighting. The modern investigators were really hopeful that they could find the gun Brashears had used on the Shearers. They were pretty certain that it was the same .22 that had been impounded when Brashears was arrested for the attempted burglary in Paragould just 2 weeks after the double homicide. They hoped the Paragould PD might still have it, but they didn't. The Paragould police had turned the gun over to the ATF, who shipped the gun to a storage facility in Texas that was hit by a hurricane, and all the records were destroyed. So no one knows where the gun is. They looked into the history of the maroon van Stephanie had reported Brashears driving, but couldn't find one that was registered to him. New Madrid County Sheriff's Office investigator Chris Hensley examined Brashears' vehicle registration history and located a blue 1982 GMC Rally sport van, which had been totaled in a collision on August 26, 1998. You'll recall that Stephanie's daughter told police she thought the van in their yard was blue, not maroon. Police think it likely that this indeed was the van Brashears was driving at the time. Another possible connection, a sexual assault kit was performed on Megan during her autopsy. No foreign DNA was collected in the sexual assault kit, but testing found a trace of isopropyl myristate. Remember what the modern investigators learned from the OG police who had arrested Brashears in April 1998 in Paragould, that during a search of his person, a tube of medication was located in his pocket. He stated it was for the treatment of genital warts. So the modern investigators researched whether isopropyl myristate had been used in medications in the treatment of genital warts in the mid-1990s. they found that it had indeed been used off-label for this affliction. So even though they hadn't obtained biological evidence that Megan was sexually assaulted, they now had an indication that perhaps Brashears had tried and left evidence of his medicated cream behind. But most importantly, the investigators showed a photo lineup including a mugshot of Brashears to rape survivor LAM and some of the other women involved in the Memphis case. Laura P. was sure it was him. LAM recognized his Facebook photo as well. The sketch they had prepared looked uncannily like him. Missouri investigators held a press conference on October 5, 2018, to announce the closure of one of the oldest and most notorious cases in state history. New Madrid County Sheriff Terry Stevens said that hundreds of investigators were involved in the Shearer case over the years. Quote, "No telling how many hours have been put into this investigation. I have no doubt in my mind that this is the most heavily investigated case this county has ever seen. Make no mistake about this gentleman. He is a serial rapist and a serial killer," end quote. The only issue I take with that statement is the use of the word gentleman. Portageville Police Chief Ronnie Adams spoke about the relief the Portageville community felt at hearing the news. Quote, "This has brought closure for the family, closure for our city, our community. I'm glad it has finally happened." Master Sergeant Bud Cooper with the Missouri Highway Patrol, who worked the case for years and is now New Madrid County Sheriff, spoke about the CODIS connection between the Shearer case and the Zatricky case, and then the Memphis rape. He also detailed the identification of Brashears by Parabon. The investigators gave the media a detailed timeline of the investigation of Robert Brashears' known crimes and asked that anyone with any additional information please contact the authorities. The Greenville investigators held their own news conference. Police Chief Ken Miller announced the identification of Robert Brashears as Jenny Zatricky's killer. He said, quote, "Generations of detectives who worked Jenny's murder investigation and gave all they had to solve it, including some who have returned in their retirements to continue this important work, are able to see this case now closed. But none of these efforts can bring Jenny Zatricky back. We can only hope that this day brings peace to her soul, peace to her family, and honor to her memory," end quote. Jenny's brother, Philip Hegedusich, also spoke. He said, quote, 28 years. It's been a long time. It's been time enough for trails to go cold. Over the course of 28 years, there were some false starts. You start taking things with a little bit of salt. We thank you for your persistence, your teamwork, and your zeal to proceed. It's been 28 years since Jenny was taken from us. The intervening years have brought the plentiful sorrow of loss and the longing for what could have been. But we do well to remember her in life. She was a force of nature, a firecracker, a bundle of infectious energy, an intelligent, vibrant, and caring human being. All of the lives she touched, near and far, then and now, should keep her in their hearts not as she left, but as she lived. So in the end, the crimes of Robert Brashears would never have been solved without the powers of modern forensic technology. We have ballistics analysis and CODIS to thank for linking the crimes he committed against Megan and Sherry, Jenny Zatricky, Stephanie W., and LAM. Those crimes, different in many ways, would almost certainly not have been connected had science not pointed to a link. But now that we have the larger picture, we can see that some of the crimes shared similarities. Brashears used ruses to try and get in the door at the homes of Stephanie and LAM, pretending he was lost or looking for something. Master Sergeant Bud Cooper believes that he likely did the same thing with Sherry and Megan, at first gaining their trust and then pulling out his gun. Those cases were all in freestanding homes near interstates that had evidence of kids outside and no man at home. The Jenny Zatricky case, 7 years before any of these others, diverges from that pattern. In that murder, Brashears demonstrated stealth, patience, and ingenuity, rather than just relying on the fear and intimidation wrought by his pointed gun. His target was not women and kids in this case, but one sole adult woman, whom he deliberately selected for unknown reasons. He didn't use a ruse on Jenny, but broke into her apartment while she was asleep. And after he killed her, he did his best to destroy all the evidence. If he succeeded in doing this in other instances, we may never know all the crimes Robert Brashears is responsible for. But at least we know that he has no additional victims after January 13, 1999, when Brashears removed himself from this earth in some long overdue, self-administered justice. After lots of different numbers of years, the cases of Megan and Sherry Shearer, Stephanie W., LAM, and Jenny Zatricky are solved, thanks to forensic genealogy. And if you're one of the bad guys, they are coming for you. Thank you to Infinity and beyond to New Madrid County Sheriff's Captain Chris Hensley, who allowed me to track him down in his patrol car and barrage him with questions. If you live in Missouri, look out for him on the campaign trail to be the next sheriff of New Madrid County. I'd just like to remind all the listeners of the raffle we have going on. Send a screenshot of your 5-star review of the show to dnaidpodcast@gmail.com and include your name and address. We will enter your name into a raffle to win some DNA ID swag. The drawing will be on May 6th. Thank you. Recently, I let listeners know about a new benefit available to them called an Abjack Insider subscription that's available through Apple Podcasts. An Abjack Insider subscription will give listeners ad-free access to every bit of DNA ID content published, both past episodes and future episodes. It will also give you benefits like early access and bonus content. Head over to Apple Podcasts and click on the DNA ID show page or the Abjack Entertainment channel to start a free trial. Thanks for listening to this episode of DNA ID. If you'd like to listen to the show ad-free and help support the show in the process, please head over to patreon.com/DNAID. And if you're interested in some fun DNA ID merch, visit the store at customizedgirl.com/s/DNAID podcast. To contact the show, please email us at dnaidpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on social media at dnaidpodcast on Instagram, at dnaidpodcast on Twitter, or on Facebook at facebook.com/dnaidpodcast. Finally, if you want to visit our website, go to dnaidpodcast.com. You'll be able to get all the episodes of the show, leave comments on episodes that I can respond to, and you can even leave voicemails. You'll get all the latest news about the show and important updates, find links to our social media, merch, and a lot more. It's really your one-stop shop for everything DNA ID. DNA ID is written, researched, and hosted by me, Jessica Betancourt. It's produced by me and Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Music by Connor Betancourt. Check out our other collaborative podcasts, Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons, and Beyond Bizarre True Crime.